Hello, Bee Culture readers. It's basically that time of the month again where another article has come around. You know, I've said in the article that's coming up, and I'm going to read to you here in a bit, that I should have been talking about something to do in the spring and management procedures or whatever, and I just didn't do it. I kind of wanted to talk about us. I'm sure other more efficient writers will be discussing that. So, to tell you, hi, that I'm Jim Two, and I'm a writer for Bee Culture magazine, and each month I give you an audio representation of the article that I've submitted to Bee Culture for written format. This month I want to talk to you about the concept of what new beekeepers should know about old beekeepers, and probably vice versa. Old beekeepers really do mean to be helpful. As I tried to write this, my thoughts just tumbled and jumbled all over each other. So let me start by wording it like this. When is one an old beekeeper with vast experience, or when is one an old beekeeper who lives in the past too much? There's all kinds of possible examples. Let me pick out a simple one. For instance, consider 5-gallon pails. An experienced beekeeper could say, "Yep, I certainly remember those old 60-pound metal tins that we used to put honey in. Remember those small, painful wire handles? Remember how the solder joints would occasionally break on those handles and drop a 60-pound can of honey right on your foot? But alternatively, having straight sides, they surely stacked nicely." Another old beekeeper could say, "I remember those 60-pound tins, but I think 5-gallon plastic buckets are much better. Better handles and easier to clean and pour honey from." So what is information from an experienced beekeeper really helping a new beekeeper? When is it a walk down memory lane? Hey, listeners, before we get away from this, let me bring up something that's been on my mind about this plastic bucket thing. When we heat those plastic buckets with drum heaters and bucket heaters, are we driving in micro levels of microplastics into our honey crop? You know, that's in all the news now, all the discussion about these micro contents of plastics in our environment and indeed in us. So I just wonder how much of that plastic bucket is at the microscopic level incorporating itself in our honey crop, if it's happening at all. Back to the article. I'm having these thoughts because absolutely everything changes, and certainly beekeeping changes. During the past 3 to 4 decades, things have really turned upside down in beekeeping. Mites, small hive beetles, viral pathogens, herbicides, food sources, you just name it. All of these things have kind of amalgamated themselves into completely restructuring beekeeping as I knew it from the late 60s, early 70s until today. So much has changed in management, equipment, bee stocks, honey production, pollination services, as to really make a lot of our established recommendations uncertain or ineffective. And I want to add to what I wrote, and in many cases, dated. Now, this is where I mentioned this. Right now, I should be writing an article for beekeepers describing what they should be doing for spring management. But what would I write? Years ago, a prominent Ohio beekeeper, Roy Hendrickson, discussed spring management in an excellent article in this magazine, and I did a piece entitled "A Fresh Look at the Principles of Spring Management of Beekeeping." I did all that, but way back in April 2007. It seems like, did we even have electricity then? Larry Connor, a good friend of mine, was referring to 1960s beekeeping hauntingly when he said, "That was a time before tracheal mites, varroa mites, small hive beetles, colony collapse disorder, neonicotinoids, and African bees. Oh, my stars, what a litany, what a list, what a litany. That's pretty much what I was saying just a few sentences ago. We are stepping all over ourselves trying to advise new beekeepers when I sense that old beekeepers need as much help as anyone. As a beekeeper trained in the 70s, I commonly made mistakes, but listeners, I'd like to say that somehow, in some way, the effects of my errors were rarely deathly severe. Accidentally killing a queen was paramount to a bad day, but queens all those years ago were readily available, and they were not that costly. That's not true for us today in beekeeping, is it? All those years ago, colonies still died in the winter, but only a few suffered that fate compared to our percentage of deaths today. And so what? You could readily make up the difference by picking up swarms the next spring, and that's not true for today's beekeeper. Mature colonies back then seemed to be mysteriously hardy compared to colonies today and would reach large populations with little to no intervention by the meddling beekeeper. Splits were therefore easy to make. Today's colonies are more delicate, more fragile. I don't know why. Good colonies today can suddenly fail. I want to step outside the article here for a minute. I'm not describing a time in beekeeping in the 60s and 70s when everything was perfect. We had horrific problems back in those decades with organophosphate insecticides and with poor attitudes from the public toward beekeeping. There were issues that were alive and well during those times. But I do have to tell you this, as a time traveler from then till now, in some way that I can't clearly describe, honeybee colonies from the late 60s, early 70s, early 80s were simply more hardy than our bees today. And I just have to blame Varroa and the mites, I'm sorry, and the viruses that they vector. That just has to be it. And then you mix in the more sophisticated insecticides of this day compared to the primitive compounds we used in the 70s. There might be that. There might be herbicides taking out so much of the floral nectar sources. Something has happened in my lifetime in beekeeping that bees just need us more. They must be so incensed that they need us more. Back to the article. It seems to me that the new beekeeper is more stressed to get things right and to get things right quicker and without errors because those errors are expensive. Increasingly, I've become a bit mouthy about beekeepers being expected to try to implement all of the old management recommendations plus all of the new management recommendations. You need to reverse brood chambers. You need to requeen frequently. You need to keep those mite treatments going, and you need to put on the correct mite treatment. You need to replace those combs every 2 to 3 years. Pollen substitutes, you better be feeding them. But don't unintentionally feed small hive beetles with the pollen substitutes. Medications, be careful that you don't have residues. And by all means, go down and tear down swarms. It goes on and on and on. Give me a break and give the new beekeeper a break. The beekeeper needs to learn to manage bees, but in learning management techniques, the new beekeeper is punished, economically in most cases, for making mistakes. The boy, I got to say at this point, just so you know, experienced beekeepers are also penalized mightily for making management mistakes, too. I'm way ahead of myself. All of my penalty comments above assume the new beekeeper was even able to acquire bees. While I'm not a fossil beekeeper, in my early years, I paid less than $2 for queens. Today's new beekeeper can easily spend 15 times that amount for a queen, if you can even find one that's available. Oddly, in my early life, package producers were everywhere. There were these small small operations, just maybe one or two people working that would shake packages and raise queens. Those guys are all gone. U.S. Postal System would ship them to me. You could buy established colonies or splits in general, listeners, readers. Bees were more available. They were more readily available. They were advertised in farm papers, bee club newsletters, word of mouth. Now a swarm call for most of us is a rare thing. Bees are just simply more difficult to get. So when you do get them and then they die, then the penalty for that is now greater. Today's new beekeeper must make careful plans to order packages and arrange to get them and probably get them through a club or a bulk order. I don't want to be that old guy telling the young people what it used to be like, but it just wasn't that difficult to get bees. Decades ago, they were there. They were swarms. They were bees in the wall of a house that people wanted gone. There were beekeepers who had more bees than they could manage. All those were options, not just having to buy packages once a year. And then you finally get this package now, and heaven forbid, you find out that the package queen died. Well, I hope you can find another one, because the package producer is probably not sending extras the way they once did. So here we are again. Making errors in installing packages today has greater penalties than I think making errors installing packages did just a few decades ago, when computers and computer systems were young. I remember distinctly I could contact my university IT people, and they would come troubleshoot these old machines, probably an old 8088 chip, dual floppy drive computer. Invariably, they had to do some mystical work like reset some of my DIP switches or whatever. Just to be sure, does anyone think I have that kind of support today? Even when I was working at the university system, we had evolved away from that. Only catastrophic issues are addressed, and they're usually addressed for pay inside the university system and certainly outside the university system. But for software, for general hardware questions, I have to go online, search for answers, figure it out myself. Today, I'm on my own if my computer system hiccups. And I want to suggest that my computer maintenance today, compared to what it was, is similar to modern beekeepers. Years ago, young honeybee queens were kinda guaranteed by the producer. Something went wrong, call the queen grower up, and they would send you another one, probably. This past season, I had about 20% of the queens in my packages die. A couple were dead in the cage even before I released the package. It was not my fault. It was not my fault, but there were no free queens. That guaranteed queen thing is essentially gone. I've had package providers tell me that if the queen is alive when they hand you the package, their obligation is over. I don't know that I can argue with that, because producing queens is such a labor-intensive, demanding thing to do. I ended up with several 6-pound packages because I had to combine queenless 3-pound packages with queen right packages. So, new beekeeper, you do whatever it takes to get through when bad luck is handed to you. I put this little story in here and I said, don't try this at home. For this queen reason I just discussed, and for several others, I was curious. I accidentally worked out a procedure that I may or may not try again next spring. This is not a recommendation for you, and it may never be a recommendation for anyone. Of the 3-pound packages I had, I took 2, and I decided to try a novel release procedure because I was having trouble with some of these queens. I released one of the packages in the typical way. It was a 3-pound package. I also opened the second 3-pound package and released about 2 pounds of the bees in with the first unit. So I used the remaining queen and the last single pound of bees to establish a small nucleus colony. So, listeners, what I had was essentially a 5-pound package and a 1-pound package. And as you would expect, the 5-pound package exploded. Now, if I'd had queen problems with that, I had a queen somewhat in reserve in that 1-pound package. But in retrospect, no problems arose, and as the season progressed, I equalized the colonies, and currently all is well with those two colonies. The question that you should logically ask me, and it's a question I can't answer, is, did I grow more bees from those two packages because I used this oversized split process? And I don't know. And that's why this is not a recommendation. I ended up in a similar place with two decent colonies, but did I end up there faster? Did I take less of a chance by having kind of a queen in reserve? I don't know. So I was just tinkering. Hey, I'm just a beekeeper, and you have the opportunity to tinker. I'll give it a shot and see how it works out. The old system of bee information dispersal is still, after all these years, alive and mostly well. Hands-on bee education classes are still offered, and there's just incredible numbers of bee books out there, and it seems there's a bee meeting nearly somewhere every night, Zooming somewhere, or live meetings or whatever. Bee enthusiasts talking, looking at pictures and people reading all about bees, and that hasn't changed, but other things have changed. There was a time when I was confident that I knew more about bees than most people in the meeting room, but not anymore. The new beekeeper can go to the web for literally anything concerning beekeeping, or really anything else. I cannot read the thousands and thousands of bee-related pages and then commit all that to memory enough to just recall it when you're standing there talking. Invariably, someone has read something that I've not seen and probably will never see. But here's the new responsibility for the new beekeeper. Not all web-based information is accurate. And I'll give you an old example. This is not a viable procedure. You move a colony because it has laying workers a few yards away, and you shake the bees from the laying worker colony and then replace the equipment on the original stand. The idea is that the laying workers will not find their way back home, and that's not true. Laying workers can find their way back home very well. Many hits are presented that give instructions for this process. It doesn't work, but you'll hear it at meetings from very accomplished, serious beekeepers. So no harm done, but it doesn't work. Let the new beekeeper beware. Another thing that's happened in beekeeping is that the industry has always been an assemblage of subgroups that comes together on bee meeting days. It used to be hobby beekeepers, sideline beekeepers, some commercial guys, equipment vendors, regulatory people, university bee professors. They all comprise this audience group. Today's new beekeeper will still be exposed to a segmented industry, but different segments from a few decades ago. Hobby and sideline beekeepers seem to have been combined. Commercial beekeepers are rare at most small meetings. Commercial beekeeper numbers are fewer. And those fewer commercial beekeepers are much, much larger operations. Commercial beekeepers have become so specialized as to nearly be a different industry than the hobby beekeeper. Many years ago, when colony collapse disorder was in its infancy, I was at a meeting with an Ohio legislative representative when, in reference to hobby beekeepers, he abruptly said, "Don't ever use the term hobby beekeeper again." He continued that either you are a beekeeper or you are not. No funding agency is going to fund hobbies. I was completely stunned. This one individual had abruptly made a term commonly found in essentially every bee book ever written, hobby beekeepers, made that term obsolete. My very first reaction was to think that the term hobby simply could not die But after considering the thought for a few minutes and seeing the opinioned firmness of this elected representative, I realized that in Ohio, at least, I had probably just witnessed the death of a time-honored term. Since that time, I've attended two state meetings far removed from Ohio, where the presenting speaker admonished the group to delete the hobby word. Today's hobby beekeeper is just a beekeeper. So it seems to me that in a way, in our modern beekeeping industry, there's essentially beekeepers and then commercial beekeepers. I mean, maybe you're a beekeeper with not much experience, or maybe you're a beekeeper with vast experience, but still a beekeeper. Now I sense that there's even other divisions, because there's pre-Varroa beekeepers. I'm one of those. We're all old. And post-Varroa beekeepers. They're the growing majority. So this, even if this is a designation, these old beekeepers are going to pass, and the post-Varroa group will definitely take over. I spent a lot of time in academic beekeeping. Past bee professors were as much a beekeeper as they were a scientist. They commonly attended bee meetings, even if they were not speakers on the program. Dr. Walter Rothenbuehler and Dr. Basil Fergala are examples of scientists from this area. USDA ARS scientists were, at the time, governmentally funded and not encumbered with the obligation to get outside grants. They were encouraged to work on problems that had immediate and direct effects on the industry. For instance, a researcher named B.F. Detroit was a USDA engineer who worked on projects like developing steam-heated uncapping knives and insulating beehives and pollen trap designs. For many legitimate reasons, academic beekeeping today is nearly completely removed from the practical bee industry. The studies they implement are specialized, and conclusions drawn are complicated and difficult to implement in many instances in traditional beekeeping. In eras past, academic beekeepers were simply doing their job when working with the bee industry, but today's academic beekeeper is stressed to get outside funding and to succeed inside the broader scientific community. That internal scientific success can have little to do with the day-to-day life of the typical beekeeper. I'm not saying this is a good or a bad thing, but it's a different thing from the way academic beekeeping was many years ago. But I know that I was distinctly feeling as I stood before a group at a recent county meeting. It was a modern group made up of these new and old beekeepers. And those of us in the old group clearly have paternal feelings and want to help these new beekeepers at every turn. Even this magazine runs articles on how to nurture new beekeepers and how to help them stay current and stay involved. That sounds like the current recommendations I discussed earlier for helping bee colonies. Do we really know how to help new beekeepers any more than we really know how to help modern colonies? We have the best of intentions, but our aid programs frequently harm our colonies as much as they help. Yeah, it's true. Old beekeepers can help with the mechanics of beekeeping, but today's bright-eyed, eager new beekeeper never knew bees without mites and always dealt with suspicious queens and had concerns about herbicides and was always about knee-deep in imported honey. This same new group didn't really expect bee professors to be at every meeting that they went to. Instead, these new people keep bees in town more often than the countryside, and then when they need information, they'll search the web or listen to a blog or a podcast, and in a pinch, they'll use old-fashioned email. When requesting information, they will rarely use a landline phone, and they will never, never write an actual letter. So the new people are different, from the old people, but they're both in the same interest area. Due to mites, insecticides, viruses, bee disease, imported honey, listeners, we're all, in a way, new beekeepers. Old beekeepers know more about the mechanics and the fundamentals of bees and beekeeping, but the new group knows more about today's ways of communicating and implementing modern beekeeping principle. They're not living in the past the way some of us old beekeepers do. New beekeepers are living in their present as they develop their concept of their past. To survive and to thrive in this changing bee world, old beekeepers probably need new beekeepers as much as the new need the old. We're all in the same bee boat, and for all of us, it's a new boat. So we're all in this together. If you've made it this far, thank you so much for listening. My whole concept was, how do old beekeepers help new beekeepers, and how do new beekeepers unintentionally help old beekeepers? We're all in this together. Again, thank you. Jim telling you bye.